Today on Wings, the U.S. lags behind on women's rights. Plus, women voters' ambivalence about Hillary Clinton.
So much of what we see and hear in the media today really want us to think about her as a caricature. We shouldn't allow her to change her mind on positions, and some people see her as the housewife. Some people see the first lady.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Women's Magazine is a weekly hour-long collective radio program on KPFA-FM in Berkeley, California, and one of its most active current contributors is Kate Raphael. Today on Wings, we have two of Kate's interviews. After the break, she talks with a member of the United Nations delegation that investigated the state of American women's rights. But first...
It's no secret to most of you that I don't really like Hillary Clinton's politics. I do, however, admire her a lot. I developed that admiration during Bill's first White House term, which coincided with the huge anti-feminist push of the early 90s. The Clintons became the symbol of everything the right wing hated about the new relations between men and women. And as such, Hillary became a symbol for feminism, for a woman's right to participate fully in her husband's work life, even if that work was running the most powerful empire on the planet. I remember telling someone that I've never felt so personally attacked by things being said about a public figure as I did listening to the things that people were saying about her. And for all that she did not stand up for poor and working class women in those days, she did stand up for every woman's right to be heard. And for that, if nothing else, I will always admire her. Now she's running for president for the second time. For the second time, she seems to be the anointed Democratic standard bearer. And for the second time, the right wing is having a field day attacking her with lightly coded sexist tropes. Like me, most women, at least those in my age group, have pretty strong feelings about Hillary. In fact, there are few political figures in our culture who evoke such strong feelings, especially among women. Joanne Cronrath Bamberger, editor-in-chief and publisher of The Broadside and author of the book Mothers of Intention, How Women and Social Media Are Revolutionizing Politics in America, has collected the thoughts of 27 women into an anthology entitled Love Her, Love Her Not, The Hillary Paradox. So, Joanne, you have a wide range of contributors in this book, from pundits to fashion writers, left, right, and center. Were there things you learned from some of the essays that you didn't know?
Through these writings by these women and how they view her, I think I learned that there are women voters who are willing to accept that she's complicated, like the rest of us who change careers, change our minds on politics.
But shouldn't politicians, including her, be held accountable for the public positions that they took, especially when those positions really have had a big impact on social policy?
I think every politician should be held accountable, but I think they should be held accountable to the same degree. A couple of the essays talk about her vote on the Iraq War, which many people have taken issue with, and fairly, I think. But there are men politicians, such as John Kerry, who have changed their minds, voted one way, and then in subsequent years said they might have voted differently, who don't receive the same scrutiny.
What things in people's contributions surprised you?
One of the things that I was most surprised about was that there were so many women who still have conflicted feelings about her because she stayed with her husband after the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and look at her and say, well, she only stayed because of her own personal ambitions, and she was looking down the road, and she knew she wanted to be president, and I'm not sure I can trust someone like that. And that really surprised me, A, given how long it's been since that happened, and B, there's plenty of men who have weathered sexual scandals and have gone on to get elected to or appointed to other political office. And the other thing that was surprising to me is that, and this is sort of backed up by some research that's been done by various institutions, 90% of women polled say that they need to feel that they like a woman to be able to vote for her. And the number is much, much lower when they're talking about a male candidate. And I was really shocked at that.
But then, of course, George W. Bush was alleged to be, I mean, I myself never saw it, but, you know, everybody seemed to find him so likable. But as a man, he didn't have to also prove that he was tough enough to be commander-in-chief?
I think that's right. And there are two essays in the book talking about we've never seen a woman who is the person who will send troops into harm's way and who has her finger on the nuclear button. And how does that comport with how we view women generally?
Though I did notice there was an article in the New York Times about how Bernie Sanders doesn't kiss enough babies and people think he doesn't hug them when they pour out a sob story. So is it entirely sexism with Hillary, or is it more just that we're in the era of reality TV and everything's supposed to be some version of Oprah or a soap opera or something?
Oh, that's a big, good question. I'm not really sure, though, what the big answer to that is. One of the things that I ask and explore in the essay that I wrote about whether we need Hillary to be perfect is, are we living in a time where women of a certain age should be done with their ambition and should just step back? And that's not a good thing for Hillary Clinton or any other candidate or woman leader of her age or of her era.
So speaking of a certain age, did you notice a generational divide or several in terms of the contributors and their attitudes towards Hillary? I mean, thinking back to what you were saying a few minutes ago about that women still carry a lot of anger towards her based on the fact that she stood by Bill in the Monica Lewinsky affair, millennials would not really have even been conscious at that time. So they shouldn't have those same strong feelings, or do they?
They don't. In some ways, the women of Gen Y and Gen X found it empowering that she had not given up her personal dreams and her personal ambitions because of something that her husband had done.
So do you have a sense of whether more people love her not?
At least in these 28 essays, there are people who totally love her and there are people who love her not. But more people are on the fence. They acknowledge that there are positive things about her as a candidate and a woman leader and a potential first woman president. Yet there are things that they have reservations about. And there are people that under other circumstances they might be more interested in, like Elizabeth Warren or Carly Fiorina or a male candidate. And I wonder if the majority of women voters in the country fall into that category.
So what is the Hillary paradox of the subtitle?
Well, I think that is the paradox. How we feel about her is very different than how most women voters feel about other women politicians today. And I think that is driven by the generation that Hillary Clinton comes from. Someone who started as a political wife, even though she was accomplished in her own legal career. But we first knew her, the public first knew her, as a first lady, the first lady of Arkansas, the first lady of the United States. And to have someone go from that role that is female traditional in our country to someone who has her own political ambitions is something that we've never really dealt with. Other women politicians, many of the senators, Kirsten Gillibrand, Elizabeth Warren, yes, they've had other careers, but we've only known them in the public eye as someone running for office. so I think the paradox is really in us and how we look at Hillary, given who she was, the generations that she straddled, and whether we are willing to allow a woman like her, whether it's her or someone who comes from that same generation, to move past the traditional role and move into what we would call a non-traditional role.
You point out, I think, in your introduction and several of the other essays point out that Hillary Clinton's a virtual cottage industry. You know, someone says there could be departments of Hillary studies coming up pretty soon because
right.
there's so many scholarly works as well as popular works that have been written about her. Is it that she kind of encompasses in some ways our sense of ourselves, at least for people who are of a generation that have like been through the arc of her career? Or do you think it's something about her as a person that causes those intense feelings?
I think it's a mixture of both. The culture that we live in today as women, this is an overgeneralization, but, you know, given what's in pop culture, we expect to be perfect. And we criticize ourselves when we're not. If we aren't able to do everything perfectly all the time, taking care of our families, taking care of our jobs, taking care of ourselves. I think we project that onto her, and I think part of that is because we've seen her in the role of the traditional wife helpmate. But, you know, she went to Yale Law School, and then she was on the Watergate Committee investigating Richard Nixon. And what if she had not married Bill Clinton? What if she had not moved to Arkansas and become the First Lady? She was already very accomplished. What if her path had taken a different route, would we view her differently today in 2015?
Do you think she can win this election?
I would love to think that we are finally at a place where the country can consider a woman as president, because I really don't think we were there in 2008. Obviously, she was qualified then, although now she's got the experience as Secretary of State. But my gut says we are at a different place now than we were 8 years ago, and that perhaps we really are ready to consider the possibility of a woman leading this country.
Joanne Bamberger has been my guest. Her new book, Love Her, Love Her Not, The Hillary Paradox. It's a collection of 28 essays about women's attitudes towards Hillary Clinton. Joanne, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Kate. It was great.
On Wings, you're listening to interviews from Women's Magazine, which airs weekly on community radio KPFA-FM in Berkeley, California. The following interview by Kate Raphael aired December 21, 2015.
Last week, the major U.S. media reported that a team of experts had toured the U.S. and found that women in the United States face a shocking level of discrimination, far worse than in most developed countries. Frances Radai was a member of that team of experts. She's a special rapporteur with the United Nations Working Group on the issue of discrimination against women, and she says that the headlines were a little misleading. It's not discrimination against women that's extreme in the U.S., although there is discrimination. Rather, she says it's lack of legal rights. Frances Radai is a professor of law based in Jerusalem. She has taught in England, Tanzania, and Israel. She's well known for her work in international human rights, as well as labor rights and women's rights in Israel. She joins me now on the phone from Berlin. Professor Radai, whose decision was it to bring a mission to the U.S.?
The United States government invited us.
Who was on this mission?
I was on the mission. Also, Eleonora Bielinska from Poland and Alda Facio from Costa Rica. And we were accompanied by staff members of the United Nations.
And where did you go?
Washington, of course, we visit because it's the seat of the federal government. Alabama, because of the situation of the black minority women and other things, but mainly that. The visit to Texas was because of the immigration, the migrant detention centers, but we examined other things as well in the place. Oregon, we chose because it's a state which is not particularly affluent as amongst the states, and yet has a rather high standard on women's human rights. We did want to go to the prison in Alabama, but that was not possible from the point of view of the prison authorities. There was a prison visit in Oregon.
Were you able to visit the detention centers in Texas?
Yes, but I went to Alabama, not to Texas.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about what you found.
The mission was a unique mission in the sense that the United States is one of the only 7 countries in the world, out of 193 countries, which has not ratified the Convention for Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. Nearly all the other countries of the world are reporting on women's human rights every 4 years to a committee of experts which assesses and gives concluding observations about the reports that they hear. And it's quite an important mechanism because it's not just the government that reports, but also the civil society organizations enter shadow reports with their complaints or their allegations as regards the violation of women's human rights. So this was a unique opportunity to open up a discussion in the United States as to good practices and or gaps between women's rights in the United States and those guaranteed under international human rights law. I'm going to just highlight the most egregious missing rights. The first is, it is required by international human rights law to give women paid maternity leave, 14 weeks. And in fact, U.S. women do not, by law, have the right to paid maternity leave, except in 3 states, and in federal government employment. And even then, it is 6 weeks paid maternity leave, not 14 weeks. And additionally, some states, another 4 states, give sick pay, which is not adequate for maternity leave. And we found that a lot of women were not really aware that women around the world expect to be paid during maternity leave and are entitled under international law to be paid during their maternity leave. This is very severe discrimination against poorer women who have faced an enormous problem. So that's the first one. I would say that the second one is the accessibility of reproductive health care, which is guaranteed by United States law and by U.S. Constitution, by the Supreme Court, as a right, and by international human rights law as well. The growing restrictions on access to termination of pregnancy, the restrictions being put on women, both by making it difficult for them bureaucratically and making it difficult for clinics to stay open because of bureaucratic restrictions, result in the fact that there are a number of states in the United States where women cannot access abortions. And again, this is discrimination against poorer women because wealthier women can get an abortion elsewhere if they want one. So that is the second, lack of legal rights which are promised under international law. And the third thing is the equal opportunity in standing for political elections. It is astounding to think that the representation of women in the legislature ranks the United States 72 in the world. In other words, they have a low representation of women. And one barrier to women in reaching political office is difficulty women have in raising campaign funding. It is a male network or interlocutors to whom we spoke said that in most of the states in the United States of America, women have a much greater difficulty acquiring campaign funding than men do, and that they regard this as the primary reason that women's representation is so low. I'd actually like to add a fourth thing, and that is the wage gap. The wage gap at the moment is 21%. I mean, there are other countries which also have a wage gap, more or less equivalent, which is unacceptable everywhere. But the United States is doing less in legal terms to close the wage gap than many other countries are, because the requirement under international law is not only to entitle women to the same wage for the same work, but it is also to entitle women to the same wage for work of equal value, which is very important when women's work is often classified as kind of feminized employment and men's work as masculinized employment. And so international law and the legal systems of many countries that abide by international law requires comparison of jobs by occupational classification under the same employer, of course.
So you mentioned a little while ago something about all of the people that you spoke with, and yes. I wanted to know more about who you met with and how you went about gathering the information.
From the governmental side, it's the responsibility of the host government to arrange meetings for us, and they arrange meetings with some Congress people from both the Democratic and the Republican side, and judges and different departments of the State Department and the Departments of Labor and Health, you know, all the different federal government departments, and some of those in the states that we visited. What we are responsible for, may I add, is meeting civil society organizations and academics, which the Secretariat of the United Nations arranges for us.
So did you meet with people from women's advocacy groups here
yes,
in the States?
Yes, that's exactly. Civil society organizations include women's advocacy groups, of course.
So after you had had the opportunity to observe and to meet with women and people from civil society, were you able to talk with policymakers about what you had observed, or does that come
yes,
later?
Yes, of course. And when we write our end of mission statement, we have a government debriefing, which means that we want policymakers to react to what we've written, because we want to be as accurate as we are humanly able to be. And we did have a government debriefing, and the remark that was made to us by the policymakers was that it was a severe report, but reflected reality.
Interesting. I mean, it's interesting because at least in the media, the findings of the report have been described as shocking.
But that is the whole point. There's a myth not held by activist feminists, but there's a myth in America that actually women don't need for the United States government to ratify the Convention for Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, because U.S. women have it all. And what our report shows is that they lag behind in many of these rights.
The U.S. often seems willing to be an outlier in terms of protections that it offers its citizens. For instance, you know, income support or the death penalty or mass incarceration. You know, it's not that people don't know that we have a higher level of incarceration than other developed countries. They just seem to feel okay about that. So I'm wondering, you know, did you have the sense when you presented your findings that policymakers were concerned or were likely to take any action to correct the situation?
There is a dilemma here. Why? The policymakers whom we met belong to an administration which does convincingly have a commitment to advancing equality for women. But it is frustrated in this commitment by such political polarization in Congress that they cannot put through all the legislation that they might have wanted to, for example, the ratification of the United Nations CEDAW Convention, which they undertook to do in 2010 and again more recently. Now, of course, it's not for us to assess what political price or lack of price has been paid by this administration to advance a program of equality for women. But this administration finishes its second tenure in another year, and these things have not been done.
And in many ways, I think with women's rights having suffered quite a bit in the last 8 years, I mean,
there's no question, the figures show it. Do you know that maternal mortality has increased 136%, whereas it's gone down all over the world? poverty amongst women has increased. Even feminist women were surprised to see the figures from 12 to 14% over the last decade, from 12.1% to 14.5%.
Wow.
With, of course, greater poverty for women than for men. And the incarceration of women is increasing. And many, if not most of them, are not being incarcerated for violent crimes. And the Bangkok rules are not being followed. Because women in incarceration under the Bangkok rules, there is an obligation to look for alternatives to custodial sentencing, especially for women with dependent children. Because women, the incarceration of women with dependent children, I probably don't need to tell you, as a feminist, does have graver implications since women are the primary caretakers. And so women, when women are incarcerated, both their children and they are exposed to the most extreme social damage.
Yeah, and I think that a majority of women who are incarcerated in the U.S. do have children.
Yes.
So what happens now in terms of you've issued your report? Will there be any follow-up or?
Yes. We haven't issued our report. We've issued our end-of-mission statement, which is quite a formidable task, especially somewhere like the United States where there is such diversity amongst the states. Now we have to write our final report. That will be an overall picture of the federal government with some examples of what's going on in state legislatures and judiciaries. And we present our report to the Human Rights Council in June of 2016. And the United States reports once every 4 years to the Human Rights Council. And it will presumably be an embarrassment to the United States government to find that it lags behind on some of these issues of women's human rights. And it will be told it lags behind by other states who are members of the Human Rights Council. It's a peer group of states who are trying to maintain human rights standards, and the United States is one of the leading proponents of this system.
Well, and I guess that's sort of part of our job as feminists to make sure that this information gets out enough to make it embarrassing for them. I've been speaking with Frances Radai. She is a professor of law based in Jerusalem, and she was part of the United Nations Working Group on the Issue of Discrimination Against Women mission to the U.S. last month. Professor Radai, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for interviewing me, because it's very important for me that our work be known to United States women.
We will link to that UN Working Group on Discrimination Against Women's End of Mission finding on our website, kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com. I'm Kate Raphael.
Thanks, Kate Raphael, for both interviews in today's show. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks to your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of The Gift and the Heart of Language. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.